Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella. As mentioned, my name is Johnny Nazarian, and I would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Thyroid Cancer, New Trends and Treatment. And this program is done in partnership with FICA, Thyroid Cancer Survivors Association. We're so happy to have them on this call today. Also, this activity is supported by ESI Inc. I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now to start, I just want to let you know how many people are on the call today. We have over 350 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. Now we also have a number of international participants from Australia, Canada, Ghana, Indonesia, Mexico, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So this really is a global call. And we are delighted to have all of you on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Mary Sebelick. And Dr. Sebelick is ABO/ABS adult complex thyroid/parathyroid surgery focused practice designation professor, endocrine head and neck surgery at the Atlanta VAMC, Emory Winship Division of Head and Neck Surgery. And Dr. Sebelick will be discussing an overview of thyroid cancer, diagnosis and staging, as well as updates on surgical treatment for thyroid cancer. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Sebelick.
Hello, and thank you for the kind introduction. I am Mary Sebelick, and I am a thyroid surgeon in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm very privileged to be invited to participate in this important education activity for many, many reasons, but one of the most important reasons is because thyroid cancer is a prevalent condition, and there are so many good things and bad things about thyroid cancer that make it very appropriate to be discussed in this format. So I have been asked to discuss or present to you an overview of thyroid cancer, talk a little bit about diagnosis and staging, and then discuss updates on surgical treatment for thyroid cancer. You know, this is on everybody's mind because it is out in sort of the general news media and social media that thyroid cancer is on the rise. Globally, we're seeing increased observation of thyroid cancer in many populations, but it does appear to be because we're finding them better. We have better screening tools and better diagnostic measures to discover thyroid cancer. So it's not entirely because cancer rates are going up. It's primarily because we're good at finding them. Thyroid cancer is the most common cancer of all of the gland-type cancers or endocrine malignancies. And thank goodness, the most common thyroid cancer is one called papillary thyroid cancer, which can have the best behavior of all the types. In the United States, we see papillary thyroid cancer in about 80, 85 to 90% of thyroid cancers. And this is the one, the variant that can be more very slow growing, not lethal. It can spread outside the thyroid gland into the lymph nodes, but interestingly, lymph node involvement does not decrease its curability or its manageability. The next most common thyroid cancer is also considered well-differentiated or acting more like its tissue of origin, and that's called follicular thyroid cancer, and that can be around 10% of the cancers we see in the U.S., in other parts of the world where iodine deficiency may be a problem, follicular cancer can be seen more often than papillary thyroid cancer, and that can be in part related to the etiology and how the cancer is discovered. So those first two, papillary and follicular, are considered well differentiated, meaning that they behave more like the original tissue. Even under the microscope, they look more like the original tissue they came from. So papillary is most common, follicular less common, but still considered well differentiated. Less frequent, about 2 to 3% of all thyroid cancers, is a special kind called medullary thyroid cancer. This can occur just for bad luck, but it can also occur genetically. It can be associated with some genetic endocrine syndromes or a very specific mutation that can run in families. That's medullary thyroid cancer. The least common and the most aggressive of this list of cancers is a cancer called anaplastic thyroid cancer. That is less than 1% of all thyroid cancers. But it also, despite it being very, very grim and aggressive and historically difficult to cure, there is hope on the horizon for treatment options that actually can bring about better cure rates or better management rates for this rare but more aggressive cancer. So that said, how does thyroid cancer appear? Well, one of two big ways. One way is a patient may feel, or a person may feel, a lump in his or her neck and then go to the doctor and have the doctor help figure out what that is. Secondly, we will often discover thyroid nodules incidentally when a person is having a scan of their neck for some other reason, some unrelated reason. And this really illustrates that thyroid nodules that prove to be cancerous may in many, many people have no symptoms. They may not be big enough to be visible or feelable. They may cause no pain or change in how the person is functioning. But the way it's discovered or brought into the diagnosis and staging cascade certainly varies. The first line diagnostic study that's recommended for somebody who can feel a lump in their neck or who had a thyroid nodule or mass discovered incidentally on an unrelated scan, the first line way we diagnose this is we examine the thyroid gland with ultrasound. Ultrasound is incredible. It gives us really, really excellent detail of the characteristics of a thyroid nodule, and it is radiation-free. Ultrasounds don't use radiation to give us our pictures, and it really can give us great detail looking for the characteristics of a thyroid nodule that may be associated with cancer. We look for things like its size, its edges, whether they're smooth or irregular, whether there are calcium deposits within the nodule, the color in relationship to the surrounding thyroid tissue. All of these characteristics that we see on an ultrasound can be used together to score or give us guidance about what to do next. Many of you on the call may have heard of a scoring system called TIRADS, T-I-R-A-D-S, and that is a radiology scoring system that takes ultrasound features and gives each feature a point or 2 or 3 points. Once you reach a certain score, then the radiologist or whoever is doing your ultrasound is going to say, okay, I think this nodule needs a biopsy. So the next step from there is to get an ultrasound-guided fine needle biopsy, and that is done with local anesthesia. And even though it sounds frightening to have somebody put a needle into the skin of your neck, it actually is incredibly well-tolerated. It is done with ultrasound guidance so that you know exactly where the biopsy is being taken. And then from there, the pathologist can look at what the thyroid nodule cells look like. From there, in many centers, the molecular characteristics or gene mutations within those thyroid cells can further be characterized to give you a really more accurate idea, is this cancer or not, what kind of cancer it is. It gives you a percentage, basically, as to what you should do next. Once you have a diagnosis of thyroid cancer or suspected thyroid cancer, then patients are put through something called staging. Staging is a system in which the original tumor is looked at for size and involvement of the organ. Adjacent lymph nodes are examined to see if they appear to be involved. And rarely for thyroid cancer, but certainly in some patients, distant metastatic disease or spread outside the neck is used for staging. Staging predicts mortality, and I already talked about it a little bit. Thyroid cancer, the vast majority of thyroid cancers are not lethal. They don't shorten a person's lifespan. But staging can also predict how much recurrence chance there might be throughout a patient's lifetime. A person may live their entire expected lifespan, but in some cases have to retreat recurrent cancer throughout their lifetime. Historically and currently, surgical management or surgical removal of thyroid cancer is the mainstay of initial treatment. One thing that's happened incredibly wonderfully over the last 15 to 25 years is we are becoming much less aggressive about how much of the thyroid needs to be removed for any given thyroid cancer. And in general, a well-differentiated cancer that is small and is confined to one side of the thyroid gland, only one half of the thyroid gland needs to be removed. It used to be that we took out the entire gland for everybody, one size fits all, and that is absolutely not the case anymore. It is important to preserve part of the thyroid gland if the thyroid tumor suggests that you can, and then also preserve the adjacent structures, including the important nerves to the vocal cords and the parathyroid glands, which control calcium metabolism. The important thing, too, is that you don't have to take lymph nodes out that are not involved, but they should be removed if they appear to be involved. I'm going to use a phrase that doctors use a lot for thyroid cancer, and that's de-escalation. We have found that aggressive surgery of years past is too much treatment, that we're not increasing cure rates by being very aggressive. So it is important that we de-escalate and absolutely customize the extent of surgery to the patient and his or her tumor. There are even very small, low-risk cancers that can be treated by watching them. That's something called active surveillance, and that is an incredible kind of a new way of looking at cancer. It takes a lot of education of surgeons and patients both to understand when active surveillance is a good idea, but it's kind of a good demonstration that these cancers are less aggressive for many, many people. Other really interesting things that are modifications of surgery include approaching the thyroid gland through not directly through the neck, but through different parts of the body, including through the mouth or through skin incisions in the chest. So that is a very exciting part of new developments in thyroid surgery. Really, my take-home points that I would like you to think about from this first section of the presentation is that thyroid cancer is very common, and in many, many people, it is indolent, meaning that it doesn't move quickly or aggressively. It doesn't shorten the lifespan of most people diagnosed with thyroid cancer. Ultrasound and needle biopsy are central to the initial diagnosis, which then can lead to staging and better understanding the appropriate treatment for thyroid cancer. This is a big take-home point. thyroid cancer treatment is very individualized. This is very patient-centered care. Your age, your life circumstances, your other health issues, all of those are critically important in helping to understand what is the right treatment for you and your thyroid cancer. And ultimately, thyroid cancer management has shifted away from one size fits all to very nuanced and very personalized strategy that balances cancer cure with maintaining the best quality of life that the person has at their baseline. So thank you for your time and listening to my presentation, and I look forward to hearing how everybody does at the end of this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Siebelick. That was a wonderful presentation. You really emphasized all throughout and then toward the end the importance of personalized care. You covered a great deal of information for our participants, so I'm sure that there will be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much again. Right, and our next speaker is Dr. Maxwell Kligerman. And Dr. Kligerman is otolaryngology, Emory Clinic School of Medicine faculty, Emory Physician Group Practice, Emory Healthcare Network. And Dr. Kligerman will be discussing updates on additional treatment options for thyroid cancer, clinical trial updates, and new treatment approaches for refractory thyroid cancer. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Kligerman.
Thank you, Johnny. I appreciate it. Thanks for the kind introduction and thanks for the opportunity to be here. Good morning and good afternoon to everybody who is on and listening. I'm really honored and privileged to be here today and get to chat with you all and try to share as much information as we can. Dr. Siebelick had a wonderful talk that really set the stage for some of the topics that I'm going to be chatting about today. The first topic I wanted to address is an update on additional treatment options for thyroid cancer. So I wanted to talk about some of the non-surgical treatments that are administered as part of thyroid cancer care. As Dr. Siebelick had mentioned, care is very individualized and very personalized. That being said, surgery is often, not always, but often one of the staples of care for surgery. However, there are a few alternative options that are available and/or additional options that are sometimes administered after surgery. So in particular, I want to talk about treatment options for very early stage papillary thyroid cancer. So those are cancers that are less than a centimeter in size and without any significant or concerning risk factors. While surgery is an option for many of these patients, there are alternative options, including active surveillance and something called transcutaneous ablation, and I wanted to touch on both of these briefly. And even though we're talking about, you know, a very specific circumstance, again, that's papillary thyroid cancer less than a centimeter in size without high risk factors, that's rather specific, but it actually incorporates many, many people. Many people who are diagnosed with thyroid cancer fit that description. Not all, but many. Active surveillance is the idea that instead of upfront surgery, the tumor can instead be carefully monitored with ultrasound. Again, the idea, as Dr. Siebelick had alluded to before, many of these cancers are indolent. That means they grow slowly, they're not aggressive, and there are not really any differences for many people in outcomes between people who just monitor and keep a close eye on the tumor and people who have upfront surgery. And the advantage for people who undergo active surveillance is that they can potentially avoid surgery altogether. Here, ultrasound is performed usually every 6 months for the first couple of years, and then as long as there are no growth or no changes, it can be done just once a year after that. However, during the ultrasound, if the tumor is seen to have grown substantially, if there's evidence of new lymph node involvement, if it looks like the tumor is growing outside of the thyroid or growing near some critical structures, or simply if the individual or the patient does not want to continue with active surveillance or if they're unable to continue with the serial ultrasound visits, then they would transition to surgery. So how often do people who are on active surveillance actually need to convert to surgery? It's actually really rare. Some studies have shown that over the course of 5 years, more than 9 out of 10 people can continue with active surveillance. It's less than 1 in 10 who actually need to convert because there are changes in the cancer or changes in the tumor. And then when they do, in fact, end up converting to surgery, it's almost always the same exact surgery that would have been offered in the first place. So that's to say that the tumor has not required a more aggressive or larger surgery. And in fact, when many people end up converting from surveillance to ultrasound, it's more often because of personal reasons than because the cancer or the tumor dictates it. Another option that we have available in addition to active surveillance for these small thyroid cancers, and in addition to surgery for these small thyroid cancers, is something called percutaneous ablation. In a way, this is a middle ground between surgery and active surveillance. So with percutaneous ablation, this is an office-based procedure where, kind of similar to a fine needle aspiration, the skin is numbed and the ultrasound is used to visualize the tumor, and the tumor cells are destroyed or ablated. Most commonly, or the most common way that we do this, is with something called radiofrequency ablation, which uses heat to ablate the cancer. But there are other options, including laser or ethanol, which is an alcohol injection into the tumor. And some studies have shown that upwards of 90%, 9 out of 10 of these tumors that are less than 1 centimeter, will completely go away with the treatment. It's not immediate. It can take months. And it is still a procedure, so there are still risks associated with it. But again, this could be a good middle ground for people who are uncomfortable with the idea of active surveillance and who are also uncomfortable with the idea of surgery. Again, the way I tend to explain this to patients and people is that it's rather similar to a fine needle biopsy, but it's just a little bit longer and a little bit more involved. But again, it's an office-based procedure where you can go home the same day. So again, we spoke about percutaneous ablation and active surveillance, which are alternative options for these small papillary thyroid cancers. Next, I wanted to talk about something called adjuvant treatments for thyroid cancer. So adjuvant treatment means additional treatments that is given following the primary treatment for the cancer. So in this case, our primary treatment most of the time is surgery. And the majority of thyroid cancers are low risk and do not need any additional treatment or adjuvant treatment after surgery. Some thyroid cancers, though, are a little bit more advanced and do sometimes benefit from additional treatment to decrease the risk of coming back. And there are two particular treatments that I'll focus on here. The first is radioactive iodine, and the second is something called TSH suppression. So with radioactive iodine, the idea here is that thyroid cells have a natural inclination to absorb iodine from our bloodstream to make thyroid hormone. With radioactive iodine, a capsule or a liquid that contains radioactive iodine is ingested, and the thyroid cancer cells that are left after surgery, which there should are often just microscopic cells left, and if there are cells left, they will take up this leftover iodine, and the radiation that's within the iodine will concentrate inside these thyroid cancer cells and destroy the cells from the inside and spare most of the surrounding tissue. This treatment is helpful in treating thyroid cancer in a couple different ways. One, it can actually kill the thyroid cancer cells directly, and the other thing that's helpful is sometimes it can help your medical team keep an eye on you and monitor your thyroid levels following surgery and make it a little bit easier to monitor for thyroid cancer too. The other additional non-surgical treatment or adjuvant treatment in this case is TSH suppression. TSH refers to thyroid stimulating hormone. The idea here is that thyroid stimulating hormone is naturally made by the brain and goes to the thyroid gland and stimulates thyroid cells. But by taking a thyroid hormone pill every day at a slightly higher than normal level, we can trick the brain into producing less thyroid stimulating hormone, which in turn can starve any remaining cancer cells of this hormone and potentially decrease their growth signal. So to recap, that was a brief discussion again on these adjuvant treatment options for more advanced thyroid cancers. Next, I'll talk a bit about some clinical trial updates, and in particular, I want to focus on kind of two particular themes for clinical trials that I think are particularly exciting, and there's just so much innovation in the field right now in this, and I think it's a really exciting time. The first is de-escalation, which again, Dr. Sebelick had referred to and had alluded to before, which is the idea that many of these cancers are very slow growing and do not need aggressive treatments. And so there are a number of de-escalation trials, which are scaling back treatment to still preserve outcomes and reduce side effects. For example, there are many active surveillance trials and or transcutaneous ablation trials that are going on across the country that are looking at treating tumors that are larger than just that 1 centimeter in size. So there are trials that are looking at doing active surveillance, for example, for tumors up to 1.5 or 2 centimeters in size. And I think that that's an exciting opportunity, again, for people who are interested in potentially avoiding surgery. Next, there are a lot of trials on neoadjuvant treatments. Again, neoadjuvant is a little bit different than adjuvant. Adjuvant treatment, we talked about before, that means treatments following the mainstay of treatment, so following surgery in this case. Neoadjuvant treatment refers to treatment before surgery or before the main treatment. And here, neoadjuvant treatment is given in thyroid cancer only rarely, and it's given for larger and more aggressive thyroid cancers. And the idea here is that we can medically target a particular tumor or a particular cancer with the goal of shrinking it before surgery and facilitating surgery. And oftentimes a corneal biopsy is performed to obtain tissue and help sequence the DNA of the tumor to find a particular genetic mutation that we have targeted treatments for. And this has really been a game changer for some of our most aggressive thyroid cancers. In addition to neoadjuvant treatment, there are also some very exciting clinical trials looking at redifferentiation. So that's kind of a mouthful, but redifferentiation refers to radioactive iodine. So that process that we were talking about before of radioactive iodine, sometimes for more aggressive thyroid cancers, there are mutations that inhibit the typical uptake of the iodine. And in these trials, we're finding ways to promote the thyroid cancer cells to, again, reuptake iodine in response to that iodine treatment. And the last topic that I wanted to talk with you about today was new treatment approaches for refractory thyroid cancer. So refractory thyroid cancer refers to cancer that is not responding to traditional treatments. And again, this field has been really taking off in a very positive way for the last several years. And it's very exciting to be able to talk with you about this because there are treatment options now that are available that did not exist even 10 years ago. And with this, we have targeted therapies that are revolutionizing treatment for refractory thyroid cancer. So this is similar to some of the treatments that are being done for neoadjuvant treatments. So the idea is that a core biopsy, which is a needle biopsy, but it's a little bit larger than a typical fine needle biopsy, but it's still a needle biopsy that's done in clinic. The idea is that a core needle biopsy is performed to sequence the DNA of the tumor to help find specific mutations in the thyroid cancer cells. And up to 75% of all thyroid cancers have a specific targetable mutation, meaning there's a specific DNA mutation that is driving the cancer. In this case, a tailored medication can be used to block the associated gene. And there are trials looking at some of our most aggressive cancers, including anaplastic cancer, medullary thyroid cancer, that have shown really phenomenal responses to treatments. And it's not a panacea. It does not work for all patients and in all cases, but it is, I believe, really revolutionizing our care. So with that, I'd like to turn it back to Johnny, and thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kliegerman. Again, another incredible presentation today. You really built on top of that foundation, as you mentioned, that Dr. Sebelick built for today. So thank you so much again for your presentation. I'm going to introduce our next speaker. Our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Maisukiewicz. And Dr. Maisukiewicz is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology, and Medical Oncology Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Clinical Director of Research in Head and Neck, Clinical Director of the Center of for Personalized Cancer Therapeutics, CPCT, the Tisch Cancer Institute, and Chairman of the Oncology Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. And Dr. Maisukowicz will be discussing preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain, the importance of communicating with your healthcare team, key questions to ask your healthcare team about your quality of life concerns, as well as guidelines to prepare for telehealth/telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Maisukowicz.
Everybody. So it has been my long journey with the entire team and this form of a podcast or educational information that we can give to our patients or even the family members. So I'm going to take you on some kind of a historic kind of a journey and the evolution of the thyroid cancer, and then we're going to discuss about some of the treatment, potential side effects, how they can be managed. So I am a medical oncologist, and I'm kind of a little bit at the end of the journey, meaning that everything else was tried to eradicate this cancer, or make the cancer disappear, whether it was a surgical intervention or whether it was the radioactive iodine. The intent of all those treatments was to kill or eradicate it or get rid of this cancer. But sometimes we know that obviously that despite those best efforts, the cancer kind of keeps coming back. And this is the moment that the patients with the thyroid cancer, they see me. And I'm going to have a little bit of a historic approach, and it's going to make sense at the end. So I would say this is the journey of precision. So we're getting more and more precise and more accurate as we invent new treatments that we can offer to our patients. So for example, and obviously because the precision, what it comes with, that more precise the medication is, less collateral or unnecessary damage those treatments are going to obviously imply on our patients. So obviously as the precision kind of goes up, there is less side effects potentially, and there is a better quality of life because the target is just the cancer and nothing else around. So I still remember, I mean, I'm a little bit older, I still remember when we are treating thyroid cancer with Dr. Rubison, and we don't do it anymore. And this is chemotherapy, though. This is very, very non-selective. And again, I'm going to say non-selective treatment that we used to use. And obviously, as you can imagine, that was extremely toxic. And for those reasons, we don't use it anymore. But as the effort was made to kind of move away from the chemotherapy, and we don't use chemotherapy in thyroid cancer, we move to what is called the targeted therapy, meaning that kind of narrows down. As you can imagine, the dart, you know, the aiming targets, obviously, we're kind of trying to get more and more precise. So with the targeted therapy, we're kind of making it an attempt to spur the patient from additional toxicity and unselectivity that chemotherapy offers and being more precise when it comes to targeting the cancer. And actually, there were two medications that were invented, and we still use them. One of them is called lenvatinib, and the other one is called sorafenib. And those, as we call them targeted therapy. So it's not the chemotherapy because they're more selective. And those medications are reserved for patients for which we didn't identify any mutation. And I'm going to comment on this later on. So basically, even if the patient does not have the mutation, we still have a targeted therapy for those patients. What's unique about those treatments, sometimes I say that those medications are like sleeping pills for the cancer. And why I mean the sleeping pill? Because what they don't do, they don't kill the cancer, but they kind of put the cancer to sleep. What it kind of implies, if those medications, they don't kill the cancer, patients are obligated to take those pills, and because they come in the form of the capsules, they're obligated to take those pills for the rest of their life as long as this treatment is working, as long as this treatment can be tolerated, and as long as the patient is willing to do so. So obviously, even though it is still targeted therapy, obviously, I'm not going to lie that those medications have some side effects, and obviously they can be managed, and I will cover how they can be managed. So compared to the previous chemotherapy, they definitely have less side effects. So again, those are reserved for patients that they don't have a mutation, or there is a mutation that we don't have the drug for. And then there is a third category that was mentioned. And the way I kind of explain it is kind of a lock and a key, because what is this mutation? It's some kind of a form of the lock, like a door lock in the cancer, and we're trying to match it with the perfect key. But as you can imagine from the door and lock analogy, it has to be a perfect match, because if I'm going to take my key to somebody else's door, I can be jiggled all day long if I'm going to do anything. So an attempt is made to first find out what kind of locks or mutations the patient they have. And there are a few possibilities. We can find a cancer that has no mutation. And obviously, if you have no mutation, no lock, I can be standing all day long with all the keys. It's not going to do anything, and I cannot do anything. The second situation is that we can find the lock, but I don't have a perfect match. I don't have a key. And again, it's not going to work. But many times what we do see that we find the lock and we have a key. And those keys are medications and the locks are mutations. And I'm going to give you some names of those mutations. They're going to sound very exotic, but it's not really important. So for example, if the patient has a RET mutation, we can use RET inhibitor. If you have the NTRK mutation, we can use the NTRK inhibitor. If you have the BRAF mutation, we can use the BRAF inhibitor. So basically, each time in this case, we have this perfect match, like a key, that goes to the cancer and turns it off. And as you can imagine, the precision comes with two facts. One, those treatments are more effective. But second, which is even more important, those treatments has less. I'm not going to say that they don't have side effects, but they have significantly less. So the first thing what we do as we see those patients, we test them for presence or absence of any kind of mutation, as I can call them locks, because we want to find the best treatment when it comes to the effectiveness, but the least toxic, and this is the attempt. So I said at the beginning that those treatments, regardless whether if you have a lock or you don't, if we have inhibitors or not, those treatments are given every day, nonstop for the rest of the patient's life, because as I said, metaphorically, those medications, they don't kill the cancer, but they put the cancer to sleep. So it is a continuous process. So obviously, as you can imagine, with the first drug, we have more side effects. With the more accurate, precise medication, we have less side effects. But what do we do when they occur? The first thing that I always tell my patients, the beauty of those pills is that most of the time, the half-life or the time that this medication spends in the human's body, it's not very long, meaning that after a day or two or sometimes a few hours, the drug is going to be eliminated from the human body. So most of the time, if there is a very, very concerning side effect, the first thing that I tell them, stop the pill. Just decide not to take it and call your doctor, and they're going to tell you what to do. Because most of the time what happens and how we manage those patients, we want to make sure that any side effect that potentially you can be suffering from can be attributed to this pill. And how are we going to find out? If we're going to stop the pill for a few days for medical reasons, if we're going to stop the pill first should leave your system, should leave your body. Subsequently, what should follow, that any complaint that you have, you may have nausea, you can have diarrhea or anything else, if the pill left your body, this side effect should get better. And this is many times what we see. So the first, we have a proof that obviously this side effect was caused by the pill. And then there is a second question, because most of the time, those pills, they come in the different dosages. It can be 400 milligram and you take four capsules. So as you know, each capsule has 100 milligram. As an example, the doctor makes the decision about what we call a dose reduction, because we say, okay, you develop some concerning side effects. Maybe we should do something about this. I know that you feel better because you stopped taking the pill. Now the decision has to be made. What's going to be the next dose? And usually this dose is lower. So this is how we manage. So I think the communication with the doctor is extremely important. So again, I'm going to repeat that. First, you stop the pill if you have any major or major concerning side effects. Second, you call the doctor or anybody in his or her team to find out and kind of make them alert that obviously you have this complaint, because you want to make sure that the complaint that you have, it can be attributed to the medication, not something else, like infection or something else. And they should be able to tell you. Usually what I do, I say, stop the pill, call me when you're going to be feeling better, when this side effect is getting better or almost disappeared, and I will tell you what to do. And usually most of the time what I do, I just dose reduce. So basically I'm trying to use another lower dose with hopes that this side effect is going to be controlled or can be tolerated. Something that I have to say, because obviously I'm not encouraging anybody to stop the pill each time when you're not feeling well, because something that we do know, that more gaps in the treatment you may have, the higher the chance that the cancer can develop a resistance, meaning the pill that you're taking may stop working. So obviously, if there is any medical reason to do so, absolutely this is the best strategy. And we're looking into two potential side effects. One side effect is the one that you feel as a patient. It can be diarrhea, can be nausea, can be pain, can be anything else, high blood pressure. So you can kind of feel those side effects, so you can call the doctor. Sometimes patients, they have hidden side effects, and it's our job to detect them. So for example, when we start any of those medications, any of those pills, even those very precise ones, I ask my patients to come back in 2 weeks so I can do a blood work, because you may detect something in the blood work that you don't feel, but this pill can cause some hidden damage. It's a side effect, and obviously I don't want to continue on the pill that can have the damaging effect. And eventually I can decide the same strategy. I'll tell the patient, please stop the pill. We want to make sure that this lab base, whatever it is, electrolyte imbalance, or it can be a liver function test that are elevated, anything that looks abnormal, I want those numbers to go down and improve. And if I see that this is what's happening, then I make a decision to dose reduce and subject the patient to the pill, because obviously, maybe not subject, but offer them the pill, because obviously I want to continuously keep putting the cancer to sleep. So those are the major strategies that we can use as we managing our patients. But obviously, the encouraging fact is that our precision goes up as we treat our patients, because those new medications are more precise and giving us less side effect. But again, the key information is going to be for patients on those medications to contact the medical oncologist to allow them to address any toxicity that you may have. And the other thing that I want to mention, that obviously the televisits and new technologies giving us the advantage that obviously in the situation like this, sometimes those things can be kind of managed remotely, that you can tell your complaint through the televisit or any other form of telephone communication to your doctor, and they should be able to guide you. So not always the physical presence in the office is needed. It varies from case to case, but this is the best way to manage the side effects. So I want to just finish with this, and I just want to thank you so much for your participation. And I hope that you're going to be spreading the message that those podcasts or those events like this are available to patients, because they are extremely informative. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Masukowicz, for, again, another incredible and very informative presentation today. You gave a lot of information out for our participants to take back to themselves, back to their care team. So thank you so much again. And our next presentation is, presenter is Ms. Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be discussing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential in your tolerance to treatment and helping you have the energy to do the things that you enjoy. Your diet might be modified either during or after your cancer treatment to assist with managing some of the side effects. Some potential side effects that you may experience could include nausea, dry mouth, fatigue. A dietitian can provide you information on any diet modifications that you may need related to your treatment. Some treatments require a low iodine diet before and after treatment, and a dietitian can help you with identifying foods that are to be avoided and those that can be included. There are many medications that you might be given to help with side effects, so please talk with your healthcare team so you feel comfortable in how to take those medications. If something's not working, please reach out to us as soon as you can. We want to help you sooner rather than later. If you're experiencing any specific challenges with eating or specific foods, with swallowing, for example, keep a record of foods that you're struggling with and talk with your dietitian. They can help in supporting you in how to find some other options or maybe modifying what you are doing, maybe with texture or just providing another solution. Hydration sometimes gets left off the list, but with any person going through therapy, sometimes dehydration can become a little bit of an issue, especially if appetite is appetite's affected, or if you're having nausea or things like that. Dehydration can actually amplify some of those symptoms, such as making you feel dizzy, maybe make the nausea even more pronounced for some folks, making you feel lightheaded or even fatigued. But fluids are anything that's liquid at room temperature, such as water, milk, sports drinks. And a general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid per day. So just talk with your healthcare team about your unique needs. In closing, there are several members of the healthcare team here to help support you during this time. So know how to reach us, and we'll be happy to support you in however we can. I'm going to close and hand the line back over. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Bearden, for that stellar presentation. I'm sure there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much again. And our next presenter is Gary Bloom. And Mr. Bloom is Executive Director, THYCA, Thyroid Cancer Survivors Association, Inc. And Mr. Bloom will be discussing THYCA, Thyroid Cancer Survivors Association's their free national programs and services, as well as their phone number, website, how to get in contact with them. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Mr. Bloom.
Well, thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to join all of you today. It's difficult to follow up after all the wonderful medical professional presentations because they were just so impressive. So thank you to all the doctors and to Ms. Bearden for all the helpful information. As mentioned, I am suffering from allergies. I apologize. I am the executive director of THYCA, and we provide a number of different free resources to patients, which I'm going to quickly go through. Our web address is www.thyca.org. Our phone number is 877-588-7904. And as I mentioned, we provide free materials. We have a very comprehensive website with information about all types of thyroid cancer. It also has available as part of it the ability to download handbooks on different types of thyroid cancer, whether it's differentiated thyroid cancer, anaplastic, medullary thyroid cancer, or pediatric thyroid cancer. We also have a very comprehensive low iodine diet cookbook that you can download. If you'd rather have a print copy of any of these materials, you can write to us. You can email us at thyca@thyca.org and request a print copy.
you have to do is tell us what you would like a print copy of and provide us your mailing address, and we'll be happy to send you a copy or multiple copies to help you through your journey. And we provide materials free of charge to doctors as well. Upcoming this October 2nd through 4th is our annual Hybrid Thyroid Cancer Survivors Conference, which you can either participate in person in Raleigh, North Carolina, or you can participate virtually from anywhere in the world. The meeting itself is free of charge. And of course, if you're coming in person, you're responsible for your own travel. We also have a very comprehensive YouTube library of recordings that you can find by going to our website. Just follow the YouTube link, and please help yourself to any of the videos which can be helpful to you. And finally, we provide support services to people through support groups as well as individual communication, either through phone calls or email, whatever works for different people. We also have specific topic support groups that people can take advantage of, such as medullary or anaplastic thyroid cancer. We also have a group for teenagers and for young adults. And we're really trying to make this experience more manageable for all of us as we go through it. And with that, I thank you all for this opportunity, and I wish you all a great weekend. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Bloom, for that superb overview of all that you offer, all the resources offered at VICA. It's an excellent resource for our participants here. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we are incredibly grateful for this continued partnership between Cancer Care and VICA. So thank you so much again. All right, and our next speaker is Victoria Puzo. And Ms. Puzo is the Support Group Program Director here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Puzo will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as our Hope Line and website. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Puzo.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for your great presentations and for providing such helpful information to our audience today. Again, my name is Victoria. I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I also oversee our support group program. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to people helping to manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops such as the one we're in today, publications, and some limited financial assistance. To become connected to any of our services, you can call our National Hope Line to speak to an oncology social worker or navigator at 1-800-813-4673. And today I'm just going to talk briefly about the benefits of connecting to psychosocial support as a patient or caregiver. A thyroid cancer diagnosis can be very overwhelming, and additional support and guidance, as well as establishing a supportive network, may help to relieve some of the feelings of anxiety related to one's diagnosis. We've learned a lot today about thyroid cancer and its treatment. We've learned that thyroid cancer is very common and also very treatable. But even so, it's normal to have difficult feelings come up during your diagnosis and treatment and into survivorship. Working one-on-one with an oncology social worker or a counselor through individual counseling can offer a space to express your feelings, emotions, and concerns. Patients and caregivers may also choose to supplement that type of individual support with a support group. Joining a support group can be a great way of connecting with others going through similar experience who may understand what you encounter throughout your diagnosis and treatment or even being a caregiver. Just like Gary Bloom said from VICA, you know, connecting to a support group can be really helpful in managing some of those concerns. And, you know, as I said, Cancer Care offers various programs that may be able to help you access support. Our resource navigation program is offered nationally to patients, survivors, and caregivers. That's a great way to help connect you with resources to access things like financial assistance, practical concerns like traveling to treatment, as well as getting connected to emotional support. On Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, There's also a wide array of reading material and information related to thyroid cancer and managing a cancer diagnosis in general. Some of the things include some of our recorded Connect education workshops, the Cancer Out Loud Cancer Care podcast, publications, and other stories of health and hope. And again, if you're in need of support or resources, I would encourage you to call our Hope Line, and that number again is 1-800-813-4673. Our lines are answered by oncology social workers and navigators who can provide you with support and guidance. Thank you all for joining us this afternoon, and now I'm going to give it back to Johnny.
Thank you so much, Victoria. You provided a very comprehensive overview of all the resources, everything that we offer here at Cancer Care, so thank you. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Okay, thank you, Bella. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. So our first question here is from Ms. Puzo. What recommendations do you have when searching for resources? I want to find resources and assistance specifically for my diagnosis, but there's so much information to go through online.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think the thing that we run into also is a lot of, you know, misinformation that might be out there. So it can be really overwhelming if you just try and Google something and you see all the different results that come up. So I think the one thing that's really important is to just try to find credible sources. So like Thyca is very good for, you know, all those really specific different types of thyroid cancer and getting information on each type of thyroid cancer. And just looking for credible things that websites that end in .gov or .edu. I think, you know, the National Cancer Institute is another really great source for information. The other thing to be really careful about is things like message boards, Reddit, things like that. You know, people are sharing their personal stories and their personal experiences, which sometimes can be really helpful, but also you don't know where this information is coming from, if they are accurate or if maybe the information they're providing is skewed or may be kind of, you know, worst case scenario type things. So just being careful about how much of that stuff you're taking in. I think it's very natural for us to want to research a diagnosis or something that we're going through, and it's great to be informed, but also trying to manage the amount of information that you're taking in because it may increase the anxiety. And then at the end of the day, if you see anything of, you know, online that you're not sure about, try to bring it back to your medical team and say, hey, I read about this. Is this accurate? And they can kind of verify some of that information for you.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Puzo, for that answer. And then, Mr. Bloom, I wanted to ask, did you have anything to add to that from FICA as a resource?
That was a really terrific answer, and I guess the follow-on would be we share information as our experience, but it's, as stated, it is our experience. And be careful about boards where people are very demonstrative, because we're very few of us are medical professionals, and very few medical professionals will be in any way emphatic or offering advice online. So if somebody's giving advice, stay far away from that, because it's probably opinion being dictated as something more than it should be. And that just heightens anxiety, which is not helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Bloom. Okay, and our next question, it's for Dr. Siebelik. Can you get thyroid cancer from having had previous chemotherapy and radiation from breast cancer, also genetic types of cancer like BRCA gene?
Wow, that's such an important question. I'm going to answer it in a couple different ways. Number one, if you personally have or you have a personal history of breast cancer and a thyroid nodule, there is a very slightly increased risk of having thyroid cancer in that nodule. They're not related. It's not cause and effect, but it is a strong enough increase that it is recommended that if you have received treatment for your breast cancer and you're in the surveillance phase, if you are discovered to have a thyroid nodule, you should have it worked up. You should be referred to have your thyroid nodule evaluated. And again, this is not meant to be frightening. It's a very slight increase in malignancy risk in an already low cancer risk setting. But if you have a personal history of breast cancer and have a thyroid nodule, you should ask your doctors to assist you in getting that evaluated. Secondly, there is not a direct correlation genetically between the two, and that's important. We do have concerns in patients who may have received childhood radiation exposure for a tumor in childhood, or who may have had an occupational exposure to low-dose radiation. Those two exposures increase your risk of thyroid malignancy and put you into a different risk category for more vigilant workup of thyroid nodules. And those are kind of the two broad categories. As I think was already alluded to, it's so important for you to communicate with your own oncology team if you have had a breast cancer diagnosis yourself, and be very much a self-advocate for having your thyroid looked at if you personally have had a radiation exposure. I'll tell you what, the numbers are hard to use or hard to interpret, but if I have a patient who does have a history of radiation to the neck as an adult, as many of the patients referred to me have, high-dose radiation to the neck for other cancers actually kind of kills the thyroid. It reduces its function. The radiation dose for cancer development is actually relatively low dose radiation. So that's an important distinction as well. Hope this answered your question.
Thank you so much, Dr. Siebelik. I have a question here for Dr. Kligerman. What and where are there studies of treatment for oncocytic cancer?
Thank you for the question. So the question was specifically about resources for oncocytic cancer. So just as background, oncocytic cancer is formerly known as Hürthle cell cancer, same cancer, just a relatively recent name change. I would recommend many of the resources that have already been discussed and mentioned previously on the conference call. So I would be a little hesitant or wary about online chat platforms, but most resources ending with .gov, many academic hospitals or institutions will have links to websites with additional information. And of course, your medical professional is always a great resource, and they'd always be happy to provide specific resources or questions or answers on that topic. And then in terms of, in addition to resources, areas that may have potential clinical trials available. So there is a website on clinicaltrials.gov that will have information on that. And then many academic hospitals and or specific designated cancer centers. So there are dozens of NCCN designated cancer centers across the country. And many of those centers will have active clinical trials on thyroid cancer, and in particular may also have clinical trials on Hürthle cell or oncocytic cell cancer, which is a minority of cancer cases, close to 3-4%, but those would be the places I would suggest to start to look.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Kligerman. And now I'm going to ask our speakers to provide their takeaways So just a brief takeaway, we'll start with Dr. Siebelik, then Dr. Kligerman, Dr. Mysukiewicz, Ms. Puzo, and then Mr. Bloom. So Dr. Siebelik.
Thank you for asking me that. And I just want to reiterate, it's been such an honor to participate and in this important topic. But number one takeaway, this is personalized medicine. That one size does not fit all. And on both ends of the spectrum, for low risk, the more common low risk cancers, the patient can, the patient's situation and family advice is really paramount. And your clinicians who help you, your surgeon and your endocrinologist, are your advisors. So this is really the hallmark of patient-centered care for cancer decision making. And on the other end of the spectrum, when you have, unfortunately, the very, very rare but aggressive forms of thyroid cancer, we have so many more tools now than we ever had. There is so much more hope for managing aggressive and difficult cancers than we've ever had in history. So on both ends of the spectrum, it's personalized care all the way. And that's a take-home message I'd like to share.
Thank you so much, Dr. Siebelik. And Dr. Kligerman?
I would echo Dr. Siebelik's comments. I think that was very well put, that we're in a really exciting era of thyroid cancer care and management at the moment on all ends of the spectrum. In terms of de-escalating care, meaning reducing the amount of potential side effects from treatment and still getting excellent, excellent results, as well as on the flip side, very targeted treatments for the most aggressive thyroid cancers that have shown extremely promising results. So again, would want to emphasize just all the new treatment options that are becoming available at the moment.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kligerman. And then Ms. Puzo?
Yeah, I would say just don't hesitate to reach out for support if you're struggling. A cancer diagnosis, again, can be, you know, really scary to go through. There's a lot of unknowns, and you're taking in a lot of information all throughout that experience. So as a patient, as a caregiver, don't be afraid to reach out for help. It's actually a really big strength to say, hey, I need to talk to someone, whether it's, you know, help with emotional support or practical concerns. Organizations like Cancer Care and PSYCHA are here to provide that support.
Thank you so much, Ms. Puzo. And Mr. Bloom?
It's always tough to come at the end because all the good answers are given. I want to thank you all for everything you've shared. I think one important comment I would add is that we at PSYCHA are very excited to see the changes in treatment, but we would encourage patients to make sure to communicate with their doctors about what expectations there are and to try to make sure that you stick with the plan that you and your doctor work out. Because even though, as Dr. Siebelik said, the prognosis for most of us is really excellent, we want to make sure that we stay on top of our care because that's the best way to ensure our care does the best for us. And again, I want to thank you all for this great program. It's a real pleasure to be part of it. And I wish everyone a great weekend.
Can I, I'm sorry, this is Dr. Kligerman. Can I make one final concluding remark? I apologize.
Yeah, of course.
Thanks. And I just wanted to make one final point that, you know, again, a lot of my presentation, I emphasize and talk about all the exciting new treatment options available for both ends of the spectrum. I also just wanted to emphasize, or, you know, I hope people don't come away with the idea that those are the options for everybody. As has been mentioned time and time again, it's personalized care. And, you know, this, our standard of treatment for many, many people and our historical treatment, which is surgery and tailored surgery, is an extremely effective and very good treatment option for many, many people. So we, you know, we have many of these alternative treatment options, but, you know, our typical standard surgery is really excellent and likely appropriate for most people.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kligerman, for mentioning that. And thank you, Mr.
Yeah.
Bloom, for your takeaway. So I just want to take this moment to thank all of our speakers. We had an excellent panel today and a wonderful workshop. It's been phenomenal. And I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was particularly exceptional because of the questions asked and the way that they were answered by our speakers. I do want to say a few words, though, just to wrap things up for those of you that didn't have your question answered. I would like you to go back to your healthcare team and ask your questions. Remember that you've learned a great deal from today's program. I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your question again and again. And then I want to remind everyone that's very important to know who to contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays. Just oftentimes when things happen and you don't know who to contact, it's important to know before, during the day, who to contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays. And I just want to mention again, I appreciate everyone's participation today. I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.